Losing your home is one of the most wrenching things that can happen to you. Few of us can imagine what it's like to be told to get your stuff out and leave. Even the word has a rather creepy sound to it, evicted. The word is also the title of a new book on the action as portrayed in one American city, Milwaukee. Matthew Desmond is the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond is the John L. Loeb Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard University and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project there. He was the principal investigator for the Milwaukee Area Renters Study, or MARS. The work led to this book and to a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant last year. Matthew Desmond, congratulations and welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So is the work in the book just a tiny slice of what you collected in MARS?
Oh, it's a pretty big slice. It's a pretty big slice. I mean, the book really focuses on the lives of eight families going through an eviction and their landlords, and kind of follows them throughout the whole eviction process and uses that moment, that very hard moment, to tell a larger story about poverty and profit in the American city and how housing is deeply implicated in creating inequality today. But there are times in the book where it rises up and talks about broader statistics and paints a larger picture, talking about things like eviction rates and the amount of number of families that are spending most of their income on housing. So the book kind of takes all this kind of data that I collected, not only doing field work and living in communities and spending time day after day with families, but also larger endeavors, and kind of brings them all together in a conversation, those data. Yeah.
You just said, though, that housing is used in creating inequality?
Yeah, and you know, we can't fix poverty in America today without fixing housing. You know, we've decided long ago, about a century ago, that most Americans should spend 30% of our income on housing. You know, that gives us enough money for food and transportation, little savings. And for a long time, most renters in the country met that goal. But times have changed, and we've reached a point today where the majority of poor renting families are spending at least half of their income on housing, and one in four are spending over 70% of their income just on rent and utilities. So under those conditions, you know, eviction is much less a result of irresponsibility than inevitability.
Well, you blow our minds on page one when you detail the first eviction. Somebody gets kicked out of their house because of a snowball fight. What in God's name happened there?
I think it's an important point. You know, what happened was met single mom in Milwaukee named Arlene, and she was trying to raise two boys. When I met her, she was spending 88% of her income to live in a pretty rundown two-bedroom apartment in a very poor neighborhood in America's fourth poorest city. And with the snowball eviction, what happened was her 14-year-old son, Jory, was cutting up, you know, throwing snowballs at passing cars, being a 14-year-old, you know, and he hit a car, and it jerked to a stop, and this man jumped out. And Jory ran inside and locked the door, but the man followed him and kicked the door in. And thank goodness he left before anything else happened. But when Arlene's landlord found out about that, she decided to evict Arlene and her boys for damaging her property. And I think that story shows how tenuous of grasp folks like Arlene have on their housing, how when you're dedicating so much of your income just for a roof over your head, something as innocent as a snowball can cause your family to be displaced.
Wow. We keep hearing about, you know, somebody who's one disaster or one hard day away from losing their house, though. But this wasn't even, it doesn't even come up to that realm in most people's minds.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that I learned throughout this process is, you know, you lose your house, but you lose so much more, too, after you're evicted. Often you lose your possessions, which are either piled on the street or taken by movers, and families often can't keep up the payments, which you have to do if the movers have your stuff. So the biggest moving company in Milwaukee that does evictions told me that about 70% of the eviction moves that they do just get thrown in the dump. Kids lose their schools, you lose your community. Workers lose their jobs. We have good statistical evidence of that. And anyone that's listening that's been evicted knows why. It's such a consuming, stressful, overwhelming event. It can cause you to kind of make mistakes at work and eventually lose your foothold in the labor market. Eviction comes with a record, just like a criminal record. And a lot of landlords turn families away that have an eviction record. It has an effect on your mental health, your depression. And so you add all that up, and I think you come to the conclusion, at least I did, that eviction is not just a condition of poverty, it's a cause of it.
Well, this instance we were just talking about, Arlene and her kids, and all the names are changed to protect people's identities. How many places did she end up living in that 1 year, for example?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I think that one thing that you learn early on when talking with Arlene is just how many places she's lived since she's been an adult. You know, she's been through countless evictions. She's moved an incredible amount of times, and it had an effect on her kids. So Jory, I remember when they were undergoing an eviction once, I remember asking him if he was upset, you know, that he'd have to go to a new school. And he told me, no, I change schools all the time. You know, between 7th and 8th grade, Jory went to 5 different schools. I remember one eviction that Arlene experienced where the movers came and it was unexpected. We weren't expecting them, and they were kind of throwing the house up and packing your stuff up. And her 6-year-old, Jafaris, came home and kind of found this scene, the surprising scene in his home, you know, all these strangers packing everything up. And he didn't do anything. You know, he didn't cry. He didn't run to get a special toy. He didn't ask a question. He just turned around and went outside and played with some other kids. We've reached a point in this country, in some of our poorest neighborhoods, where eviction has become normalized, where eviction does not elicit responses from children. I think that should trouble us.
Yeah, it should. It's a real here-we-go-again kind of thing, even for the kids. And what about the rate of evictions over country, over time around the country? What are we finding out about what's going on with the rate of evictions?
When you read accounts of evictions from the 1940s, 1930s, you get a clear impression that they were rare, and they used to draw crowds, and they used to be scandalous. We used to move people back in. But it's gotten to the point today that eviction has become, frankly, commonplace in some of our poorest neighborhoods.
The book is called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. That's Matthew Desmond's book. He won a Pulitzer Prize for it just last week. We'll return to the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Matthew Desmond is co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard University. The project's Milwaukee Area Renters Study, MARS, focused on evictions and the people involved in the transaction on both ends. It led to the book Evicted. Just last week, Matthew Desmond won a Pulitzer Prize for his work. He joined us in March of last year, so we can't take any new phone calls today. Why Milwaukee for your focus initially, Matthew?
I wanted to write a book that told a larger American story, and I think that the story of the American city is written a lot of the margins. So we write a lot about cities that we consider our biggest successes, like New York and San Francisco, and we write a lot about cities that we consider, some people consider, to be our biggest failures, like Detroit. But I think Milwaukee is somewhere in the middle, you know, and I think that if you write about what's happening to families in Milwaukee, you have a shot at representing the experiences of people in St. Louis and Cleveland, San Jose, and other places all around the country.
So you followed 8 families, and this is private housing only. We're not talking any public housing projects, right?
That's right. And I think that most Americans still believe that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or benefits from some kind of government assistance, but the opposite is true. Today, only about 1 in 4 families that qualify for any kind of housing assistance receive it. And the waiting list for public housing in some of our big cities is not counted in years, it's counted in decades. So if you're like a young parent and you apply for public housing in Washington, D.C., you might be a grandparent by the time your application comes up for review. That's the situation that many low-income families are in now, and that's why so many of them are spending almost everything they have on housing.
So let me get back to the number, 1 in 4. So for every person who gets assistance, 3 other people have applied and didn't get it?
That's right. And it's not because they're rejected. It's not because they don't meet qualifications. It's because we as a nation have not decided to support affordable housing for low-income families. There's just not enough aid to go around. And so that would be a situation that's pretty unthinkable when it comes to other kind of basic needs. So imagine if we turned away 3 in 4 families that applied for food stamps that said, I'm sorry, you have to go hungry, or we turned away 3 in 4 families that applied for unemployment insurance. Said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're going to do. But that's exactly how we treat low-income families in search of affordable, stable shelter today.
Did there used to be more money, more HUD money in here or something?
It used to be we've made different investments in the past. And in the past, the lack of affordable housing in our cities hasn't been as acute as it is today. And so we had an experiment with public housing, large, big towers in our cities that had a lot of different consequences. But one thing that we did is just defund public housing, and we allowed these massive towers that were designed to replace slums to become slum themselves. And we kind of went from a, kind of an era of public housing to an era of housing vouchers, where our biggest kind of support for low-income families in terms of housing assistance is a voucher. And if you have a voucher, you can kind of take that and spend only 30% instead of 70 or 80% of your income on rent. Vouchers make a huge difference in the lives of families that have them. We just don't have enough of them. You know, they serve only a lucky minority of poor families.
Did we scare ourselves out of public housing? Because, you know, the stories are legendary, like Cabrini Green and Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis, and I'm sure Milwaukee probably has a similar story in its past.
I think the story that, for me anyways, it's important to recognize that, you know, when we first built public housing, it was the forefront of the progressive agenda. And when you hear interviews with families that were moving into public housing, it was amazing, you know, and it was this wonderful thing. And it was this social reform, this massive reform that had so much potential and possibility. But we just defunded it. You know, we just defunded it. We took money away from it. We allowed the housing to deteriorate. Families that could move out of there did, and it left behind really atrocious housing conditions. It concentrated crime in a really terrible way. And I think it gave us the impression that public housing itself kind of was a social failure. I don't think that's the right story. I think that the story is any kind of intervention that you go big on but then decide to pull the money back on is bound to fail.
Matthew Desmond's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. You followed 8 families. Were any or all of them receiving any housing assistance?
No, none of them were. So they were like most low-income families today.
So just right on the edge. I mean, poor enough to be in bad conditions, but not poor enough to get the housing assistance.
No, I think you have it wrong there.
Really?
I mean, you can be bottom level poor and still not get housing assistance. It's not the fact that it's not kind of a liminal space. It's the fact that families that are living on $2 a day, $5 a day in America, living in deep poverty America, they're not receiving housing assistance either. There's just not enough aid to go around.
Wow. So are the people who are getting housing assistance making even less than that?
So it's not an income-based thing. You know, it's not based on, you know, certain cities have different qualifications. You know, certain cities give priorities to folks that are in homeless shelters, for example. Most people that are living in public housing today are either the elderly or the disabled. So a lot of times public housing that was erected originally for low-income families kind of got turned into elderly housing or disabled housing. So we've reached a point that they're just literally not enough to go around. And so this 1 in 4 statistic that I quoted earlier, the idea that 1 in 4 families that qualified for aid receive it, those 3 families, it's not because they make just a little too much money or not enough of it. It's not because they're disqualified for the aid in some way. It's just literally like the funds run out. Like we shut the list. I remember being with Arlene one day in Milwaukee, and she went to the housing authority, and she asked about the list. That's what we call it in Milwaukee, the list. And it's for rent assistance, for housing voucher. And she was just told the list is frozen because on it were 3,500 families that had applied for rent assistance 4 years ago. So if Arlene wanted a housing voucher, what she would have to do is wait, you know, another 3 or 4 years till the list unfroze, then wait another 4 or 5 years until her application made it to the top of the pile. And then she'd just have to pray that the person reviewing her application would ignore all the evictions that she'd collected while trying to make ends meet in the private market unassisted. Arlene's story is the representative story. Arlene's story is the story for most low-income families today.
So there's never any shuffling of the list. I mean, nobody's ever reviewed for like, oh, look, your income went up. We can take you out of housing assistance now or anything like that. It's just when you're on, and when you're not, you're not.
There is some analysis of list, and there is some talk about having a hard look at that. I think we as a nation need to kind of have an honest conversation about which housing programs we've really funded and supported. And so we do have a universal housing program in America. It's just not for the poor. It's for the middle class and the affluent in terms of tax breaks for homeowners. So the year that Arlene was evicted, we spent as a nation about $171 billion on tax break from homeowners, like the mortgage income tax deduction. And we spent about $40 billion on direct assistance to the needy, people like Arlene. That number, $171 billion, it's a large number. It's like the total budgets for the Department of Education and Justice and Agriculture and Department of the Interior combined during that year. And so I think we just need to be honest about that. You know, that we could, we have the resources in this country. And if poverty persists, it's not for lack of money. We lack something else.
I do remember George W. Bush talking about wanting to encourage an ownership society. So there was a public discussion there, but we've never really defined, I think, particularly well what that means and what the advantages are.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, putting working families on the track to home ownership in some cities works really well, you know, and there are states like Texas that have had enormous success doing that. I think that our cities are very different. You know, one city needs to build, another needs to tear down. They have different problems and gifts, and our public policy should be very different too. What I always come back to is the problem of scale. You know, we are in a situation where most poor renting families are giving most of what they have just on rent and utilities. And under those conditions, we need a solution that can meet the problem at its level, you know, and I think we can't just put all of those folks in homeownership in a way that's quickly and expediently and can address the scale of the problem. And that's why in the book I kind of come down on the position of a universal voucher program, taking a housing voucher program that we have that works well and just expanding it to families below the poverty line, all families.
Matthew Desmond from Harvard University is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He takes a look at eight families in Milwaukee and two landlords as well and walks us through the eviction process several times over. Let's get to some of the specifics about Milwaukee. This is a very different place economically from what it was in the late 70s, early 80s, for example.
That's right. So Milwaukee is a Rust Belt city. It was hit hard by deindustrialization. Between 1979 and 1983, Milwaukee lost more jobs than during the Great Depression, about 50,000 jobs. And the city's never really recovered from that shock. And so I think that thinking about the economic base of cities like Milwaukee and Cleveland and Indianapolis and Detroit is really important. And it's a conversation that a lot of us often have. You know, if you ask politicians on both sides of the aisle what they think we should do about poverty in America, how they plan to address the fact that America is different from any other rich democracy for the depth and expanse of its poverty, most will say jobs. Most will talk about the labor market. That's good. That's a necessary conversation, but it's only part of the solution. I think housing has to be at the top of the domestic agenda, too.
There are some other issues that to bring in here, too, like how the state of Wisconsin approached welfare reform in the 1990s, because it kind of changed things from how they had been before.
Yeah, that's right. So Wisconsin was at the epicenter of welfare reform, as Jason DeParle writes in his very important book, American Dream. And it was the first major American city to kind of reform welfare and turn it into kind of a works program. And that resulted in tens of thousands of parents being pushed off the welfare rolls, and it resulted in a lot of folks entering the low-wage labor market. That enormous policy, which soon became not just Wisconsin's but the nation's, has largely been heralded as a success. You know, we saw incomes rise a bit. You know, we didn't see child poverty rise as much as we thought we would after welfare reform. But I think that what my book and other books now are chronicling is is a revision of that story, and the fact that there's so many people living on so little, not only because their incomes are so small, but because their housing takes so much of what they have. And that's causing massive instability within families and communities, and it's a problem that we can address in a powerful way.
Rebecca sent an email in. She writes, if this family, and I think she's talking about Arlene's family, has been evicted many times, I suspect that there may be quite a few more problems than the speaker has alluded to. Then she asks, do the housing benefits go to people, seniors and disabled, for example, without kids?
Yes, they do. Children is an interesting part of the story. You know, when I first started this research, I thought that children would kind of shield you from eviction. There would be some protections from you, from eviction for you, but the opposite is true. And the face of America's eviction epidemic is moms with kids. And if you go into about any urban housing court in the country, you just see kids everywhere. In the South Bronx, until recently, the housing court had a daycare because there were so many kids coming through the door. We found that in Milwaukee, what differentiates why someone gets evicted and why someone kind of escapes eviction is kids, living with kids. You can hold constant how much you owe the landlord, your household income, other things like that. And having kids in your home increase your chances of getting evicted by about three times.
Increase your chance of getting evicted. Wow. And not the other way around.
That's right. And what you're seeing in that decision is not, you know, court discretion, but landlord discretion. You know, kids can be hard on landlords' bottom line. And I think landlords sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, decide to work with you but not me because I have kids living in my home. So I think that's an important part of the story. I think to Rebecca's point, you know, look, I mean, poverty's never just poverty. You know, it's a lot of things. It's a tough situation that compounded adversity. But I think that addressing housing is a really smart and powerful way to give people a foothold toward economic stability and human flourishing. Without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. And so I think it is a place to start, a very powerful place to start.
Matthew Desmond is the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Here's Jay in Medford. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. So the comment I had was, here in Oregon, there's recently been an effort to raise the minimum wage. And we have what would be considered relatively low-cost housing, but we try to maintain it well, and I noticed that it seems like a fair percentage of the workers that come would be unskilled workers. And my concern is that when their minimum wage is required to be risen, I'm sure that the cost to the contractor is going to rise, so the cost will be passed on to me, which will then be passed on to the renter, which it seems counterintuitive to raise, to try to maintain a housing cost and at the same time from the bottom be forcing that cost to go up. Thank you for your time.
All right, thanks for that. So do higher minimum wages, for example, chase up the rents?
We don't know the answer to that question empirically. And I think that if you look at the history of housing in the United States, you do see moments where rising wages did lead to increased housing costs. You know, in the 1830s, when workers rose up and went on strikes to demand wage hikes, landlords supported the workers. They didn't support the industrial capitalists because they knew that higher wages would allow them to command higher rents. So you do see moments of like this historically. And so I think the caller has somewhat of a point where, you know, we do need to focus on raising the floor and to give people wages that allow them to thrive and flourish. But we also need to be very aware of their expenses. And if we don't address things like housing costs, then our efforts to address poverty only by raising incomes are going to fall short of the mark.
Obviously, you didn't just focus in the book on people who'd been evicted, but also on the landlords. You talked to a couple of them. So let's talk about Sharina, for example, on the north side of Milwaukee. How and why did she get into the business?
So I knew that if I wanted to get the story right, I had to get landlords' perspectives. You know, I had to understand what drives them and motivates them and why they evict me but not you and that kind of thing. So if you are getting evicted, I want to get just as close to your landlord doing the evicting. And so, you know, Sharina is Arlene's landlord, and she got into the business 4 years ago. You know, when I met her, it was 4 years ago, 4 years prior. And she had been a public school teacher, and she had an entrepreneurial spirit. She kind of wanted to see if she could make a living out of being kind of a businesswoman in the inner city. And she could, and she made a decent living. You know, when I started this book, I wondered why would you buy property in some of the poorest neighborhoods of a city? And when I ended the book, I thought, why wouldn't you? The profits are there. Sharina made, in a single month, what many of her tenants made in a year. And so the picture is very complicated, but I think that there are profits to be made in their poorest neighborhoods.
Made in a single month in total income or just from the rental properties?
In both. I mean, that's the same for her.
Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City is the book. New Pulitzer Prize winner Matthew Desmond, its author. We'll hear more of this on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Matthew Desmond teaches social sciences at Harvard University and is co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project there. A study of evictions from rentals in Milwaukee led to the book Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. As of last week, it is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. The author joined us in March of last year. We get back to him now with a reminder that it is pre-recorded, so we can't take new phone calls today. Matthew, I read a quote from you somewhere saying that what you saw in this experience shook you to the core. What did you expect to see?
I don't know. I'll tell you what I did see, though. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw Arlene get evicted the coldest day on record in Milwaukee when it was below 40, below zero with the wind chill. I saw Mother's Food get piled on the sidewalk. I was in eviction once where we went into the house and it was just kids. And what had happened was the mom had passed away, and the kids had gone on living in the house. And it was a rainy, kind of a cold spring rain in Wisconsin, and you know, the sheriffs and movers moved the kids out, put their stuff on the wet sidewalk. The landlord changed the locks, and we drove on to the next eviction and the next one. I think that, you know, Evicted chronicles those moments because I think those moments are the reality for many poor families today. But it also chronicles moments of heart and brilliance and spunk and humor in the face of adversity. You know, it talks about this time where Crystal and Vanetta, who are these two homeless women, were at McDonald's, and this boy walks in, and he doesn't go up to the counter to order. He looks around for scraps. You know, he's going around to the tables. And, you know, Crystal sees him and says, "What you got?" to Vanetta. And these two women who were homeless, who had met at a homeless shelter and were looking for housing after their evictions, pulled their change, you know, bought this boy lunch and sent him on his way. Those stories are in the book, too, because I think that they showed me how powerfully and gracefully people refuse to be reduced to their hardships.
Yeah, they won't be defined by the bad things that have happened to them. I'm still struck by the fact that it seems like there's a whole infrastructure for evictions in Milwaukee, and I know it's not the only place like this. I remember seeing the same sort of thing in Roger and Me and Michael Moore's movie in Flint. But the idea that there's all these, it's like the whole sub-economy waiting to click into action when an eviction notice is posted.
There is. So there are now moving companies who have crews working all day, every work day, executing eviction moves. There are sheriff departments who have whole teams whose job it is to carry out eviction and foreclosure orders. There are literally hundreds of tenant screening companies in the United States that collect eviction records and credit records and sell those to landlords and anyone else that's interested in screening different kinds of folks. There are storage unit companies that have come up around to store evicted families' things or auction them off if they can't make the payments. So there is kind of a an apparatus, if you will. There are all sorts of folks that are involved in this problem. Yeah.
You do get a look at both sides of Milwaukee. So we're talking about the poor black north side and the poor white south side. Similar situations in both? Anything particularly very different for, in either case?
You know, eviction affects the young and the old, the sick and the able-bodied. But it has an acute effect on low-income communities of color, and especially women and mothers in those communities. So in Milwaukee, among renters, 1 in 5 black women report being evicted sometime in her life, compared to 1 in 15 white women. 1 in 5 is an incredible amount of folks. And so, you know, how I've come to think about eviction is we know that incarceration has become this common and consequential moment in the lives of low-income black men. Eviction is that for low-income black women. You know, we have low-income black men being locked up and low-income black women being locked out. And but it's not just in those communities either. You know, it's in predominantly white communities, immigrant communities. Today in America, 1 in 5 of all renters report spending at least 50% of their income on housing. So this isn't just a problem that's in our inner cities or frankly, you know, in our expensive cities like New York and San Francisco. This is a problem that's facing Americans all across the nation.
You know, it seems like there's still a Dickensian strain in I don't know if it's all human thinking or all Western thinking or something, but if you're poor, it's your fault. And I believe you address some of this. You certainly get into a chapter called Lobster on Food Stamps, where you do find somebody who actually did spend some of her food stamp money on lobster. Tell us about where she's coming from there, though, because it's really interesting.
So this is my neighbor, Lorraine, and we lived in the same trailer park. And she was a grandma. She received disability. And she was celebrating an anniversary of her boyfriend that had died recently. And on that anniversary, she took her entire monthly allotment of food stamps and she bought a really expensive dinner, you know, that lobster and king crab and a lemon meringue pie and a Pepsi. She really liked Pepsi. And she ate it in one go. And when I found out about that, I was frustrated with Lorraine. You know, I was a bit angry at her. But she didn't apologize. And she forced me not to apologize either. You know, I felt that my job was to really understand why she would do that. And I want to make it clear that Lorraine is like that she didn't do this a lot, and folks in the book didn't do this kind of thing. But it still was something that I felt that I needed to write about. And I came to the conclusion that, you know, Lorraine isn't poor because she does things like that. She does things like that because she's poor, you know, and she was living below the poverty line. She was spending over 70% of her income to rent a trailer that was in a trailer park that was considered an environmental biohazard by the city of Milwaukee at the time because it had so many housing violations. Under those conditions, there's no amount of scrimping and saving that could lift Lorraine, just a stable poverty, you know, let alone, you know, kind of some sort of economic viability. You know, so if you're in those conditions, you know, why not pepper the suffering with pleasure? You know, why not live a little? And I think that, Lorraine did. She didn't spend that much because she had an abundance of food stamps. You know, she took it on the chin because she did that. You know, she went hungry. She had to scour food pantries to make ends meet for the rest of the month. But she didn't regret what she had done. And I kind of came around to understanding her perspective on that. We can't live by bread alone. None of us can. And that goes for folks like Lorraine, too.
There was a phrase you turned around in there, but it was similar to what you had said before, though, about, you know, poverty causing evictions. But evictions cause poverty, you say. Give us a little more insight into that one.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, one thing that we know is that eviction comes with this record, right? It stamps you. It has a blemish. And that causes a lot of landlords to turn you away. And it causes a lot of public housing authorities that disperse housing assistance, like public housing and vouchers, to actually turn you away, too. So we're systematically denying aid to families most in need of it, and that forces evicted families into worse housing, into worse neighborhoods. We know both of those things are really bad for children's health. We know that the effects eviction has on your mental health, on your job security, on the on your home, you know, and not just, you know, bouts of homelessness, but, you know, all your possessions and your neighborhood and your school, everything that makes up a community. So if you add all that up, if you take all that in, you know, eviction is not just a bad day. And it's not just a result of poverty either. It's causing poverty. It's making things worse. It's casting families on a harder and much more difficult path.
We have a call here from Ruth in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Desmond, the author of Evicted.
I just want to really thank Mr. Desmond for this book and for your putting it on the air. I think I've been listening to NPR this week about poverty, and the more the general public realizes how prevalent poverty is and the high cost of rent. They did a story today about Washington, D.C., a young mother in a one-bedroom apartment paying $700-something, and it was very bad conditions for the family. She had two little children, and her mother was helping her. And my point is, this is why Bernie is so popular with young people, because young people are facing these things. Maybe the rest of us have had a little cushion underneath us. I'm in my 60s, but young people are facing this front on, and we need to rethink everything. When you hear all the industry that's making money off of these evictions, it's like the loans companies that give people that are poor these loans, it's huge.
Oh, the payday loans are mentioned in the book, too. Yeah.
There's so many factors that we're taking advantage of poor people to make the economy go. We've got so much to rethink. That's why Bernie is so popular, and I so appreciate what you're doing. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ruth. Appreciate that. Thoughts from you, Matthew?
Thanks, Ruth, so much for calling in. I think that she's right. A lot of young people today, even young people coming out with college degrees, have a really hard time affording housing. And home ownership is becoming kind of a dwindling dream in the minds of a lot of low-income families today, and young people all around the country. And I think that the thing that I'm encouraged about is we're having a public conversation about inequality today. We're having a public conversation across the aisle about it. And I think that part of that conversation has to be the question, do we believe that housing is a right? Do we believe that access to decent, affordable housing is part of what it means to be an American? And I think we have to answer yes, because without this fundamental human need, you know, economic mobility and human flourishing are impossible.
So we haven't addressed one part of the subtitle here, poverty and profit in the American city. And you quote Martin Luther King, who I'll quote here badly, but he talks in essence of the fact that when somebody is in a bad set of conditions, it's because somebody else is making money off of it. So who's making money? Who's making the most money, I guess, is the larger question here, but off of evictions and keeping people in lousy housing.
So I think that, as Ruth said, you know, poverty isn't just a product of low incomes. It's also a product of exploitation. You know, it's a product of the fact that some people are making a living, sometimes a killing, off of off the pockets of the poor. And this is a story about certain kinds of educational institutions. It's a certain kind of lending or fringe banking institutions. And the housing market plays a role here, too. The book works really hard to complicate the relationship between landlords and tenants. It's not simple. And I think we do let ourselves off the hook if we say, oh, these tenants, they're so irresponsible, or, oh, these landlords, they're just greedy. The book tries to paint a much more complicated picture. But there's no denying that there are serious profits to be made. The landlord of the trailer park that I lived in made six figures off of a you know, pretty rundown trailer park in the fourth poorest city in the country. That's literally a lifetime difference. A lifetime separates what he was making from what his tenants working minimum wage are making. I just think that's something that has to be on the table when we discuss these issues.
And on the north side, you write about Sharina complaining about how it cuts into the margins when she has to evict people and they haven't paid their rent and all that stuff. But then you also mentioned a few minutes ago about how much money she makes compared to the people that she's throwing out. So it sounds like overall she's not doing badly, but, I mean, is there some level of poor mouthing going on here?
Eviction is a part of Sharina's business model. You know, she's in eviction court every month. And The reason is because so many of our tenants are spending almost everything they have on housing. So then you might think, well, gosh, Sharina, why don't you just lower the rent, you know, so you don't have to incur all the expenses for an eviction. And the answer is it's cheaper for Sharina not to maintain her properties than it is to evict folks. And she doesn't have to maintain her properties up to code if folks are kind of perpetually behind. So there are laws on the books that prevent, you know, say, landlords from, you know, not fixing the plumbing or, you know, ignoring the cracks in the windows and those kind of things. And they're, I think if you and I looked at those laws, we'd say they're pretty fair and decent. You know, you can withhold rent from a landlord. You can call a building inspector and report your landlord's housing problems to the city. But for tenants like Arlene that have to rely on landlord's compassion one of these days, often moving in behind from day one because they can't afford first month's rent and a security deposit, let alone much else. And so under those conditions, kind of landlords like Sharina, to use Sharina's words, say, you know, you make me a deal, I'll make you a deal, you know, and that's the situation. So many times the eviction is caused by falling behind, but it was spurred or initiated because, you know, a tenant called a building inspector or some other instance. And so you're right that evictions do cost Sharina some money, but she's learned to fold that in and she's made certain trade-offs.
It's part of her business model.
It's part of her business model.
Wow. It's some pretty amazing stuff in this book and a lot of hard work that went into it, and it's really appreciated. The book is called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond, the author. Thank you so much for joining us today, Matthew.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.